This is the Disability News Program on Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm your volunteer reader, John Curry. Thanks for tuning in. Today's program begins with a piece from the New York Times Magazine entitled ASL by Hannah Seo. When I arrived on the second floor of a commercial building in Manhattan for my first sign language class, a man took one look at my tentative posture and held up some fingers. One, two. I put up one finger and he shepherded me to the level one class. It was disorienting. Class time was strictly voices off to encourage immersive learning and to show respect to the teachers at the Sign Language Center, who are all deaf. Without the power of speech, all my classmates and I could do was smile and nod at one another, sitting in silence as we took in the new vocabulary, or ASL-ery, presented to us. Learning ASL was both a culture shock and a bruise to my ego. As a writer and journalist, I pride myself on a certain facility with language. I was taught that there's an optimal combination of words that can most precisely communicate any thought. Often, my preoccupation with language as the primary tool for expression has meant that in talking or writing about my emotions, I've held them at a distance. This is compounded by the fact that learning a new language or speaking in a language that I haven't mastered is always frustrating. It's why I avoid situations where I'd have to speak Korean. I never spoke it growing up, and I communicate with the vocabulary of a six-year-old. My deficits make me simple, unfunny, and a bit childlike, and too direct. Not at all as I imagine myself to be. With ASL, I expected to feel similarly, and thought fluency would come once I collected a critical mass of signs. The first thing you learn in ASL class is the alphabet. As my classmates and I asked and answered questions using words we didn't have the signs for, those early weeks were filled with laborious spelling. This was embarrassing, seeing a dozen politely smiling faces watching me as I slowly spelled, misspelled, and restarted spelling words, often multiple times, was its own kind of purgatory. Over time, I picked up on new conventions like waving a hand or stomping on the ground to get someone's attention, and gleaned that the lights flashing in the corner of the classroom was the doorbell, alerting staff to let someone in. My fingers stalled as they reached for new shapes, and I struggled to differentiate very similar-looking signs like movie, COVID, and cheese. Eventually, I realized that when you're communicating in sign language, diction is not as important as the way you embody what you're communicating. I once asked a teacher how to sign the word desperate. ASL doesn't have a direct translation of every English word, he told me. If you want to sign desperate, you might just sign the word want, but with the appropriate facial and body posturing to show your desperation. Shifting to a visual language teaches you that everything you want to say can also be shown, and not quite in the writerly show-not-tell way. Instead of saying, a dog jumped on my lap, for example, a signing storyteller might show you how big the dog was, the angle it approached from, and whether it ran over from a distance or just clumsily plopped down. Letting go of the need for precise language and the need to translate every signed sentence into an English one in my mind was possible only after I embraced ASL's emotionality. This was easier said than done, though. My facial expressions tend to be muted, so learning how to adequately emote while signing has been my greatest challenge. One day, during a level 2 class, a teacher called me out on it. It doesn't make sense for you to sign frustrated if your face doesn't look at all frustrated, she told me. It's like speaking in a deadpan monotone while claiming you're angry. I felt as if I were back in kindergarten, learning to distinguish among emotions. During those classes, feeling stiff and unwilling to make a fool of myself, I'd avoid volunteering answers. My face softened over the months, but I could not, and still sometimes struggle to, intuit the lines between under-emoting, emoting just enough for vibrancy and humor, and goofily exaggerating. Even now, with no way to hide behind my usual euphemisms or analogies, emoting still feels at times too frank and candid. I've returned week after week to ASL classes for almost 2 years now. I can hear, and when I began studying, I did not know any deaf or hard of hearing people. My initial reasons were myriad and low stakes. As children, my sister and I were obsessed with secret languages. A high school friend with a hard of hearing sister taught me to sign and got me hooked. I wanted the ability to talk in a loud bar without shouting. But those reasons didn't capture what has made studying ASL so rewarding. If someone tells you how they feel, they might not say the word astonished, affronted, or overjoyed, but they'll show you with their face and body. And that showing will lead to something unusual for someone as invested in language as I am. You'll understand because you'll feel it. While ASL may not wholly share a vocabulary with English, that doesn't mean it lacks precision. Its precision, I've learned, lies in the common language of the body. The poet Adrienne Rich writes of silence as a blueprint to life that has presence and form. For me, signing made that blueprint clear, showing me that the body is what gives language life. Access to that language required that I attune myself to emotion, both my own and others. And now we have a notice from the City of Chandler. Nominations for Chandler's 2025 Disability Awareness Awards are now open. Chandler, Arizona. The Chandler Mayor's Committee for People with Disabilities is now accepting nominations for the Disability Awareness Awards, which celebrate individuals and organizations that make outstanding contributions to the disability community. These annual awards help raise awareness about physical and developmental disabilities, showing the importance of inclusion in Chandler. The Disability Awareness Awards celebrate both individuals who have overcome personal challenges and those who work tirelessly to promote inclusion, accessibility, and opportunity in our community, said Committee Chair Tom Fay. These champions help make Chandler a more welcoming city for all residents. Applications for the 2025 awards are available at Disability Awareness Awards and are due by Friday, January 31. The awards are free to enter and open to all Chandler community members. The six categories include Student of the Year Award, given to a student with a disability who has excelled beyond their apparent limitations, Educator of the Year Award, given to an individual who has worked in the field of training or educating people with disabilities, Volunteer of the Year Award, given to an individual who has contributed consistent and outstanding service to people with disabilities, Employee of the Year Award, given to an employee with a disability who has overcome barriers and has excelled in the performance of their work. Employer of the Year, given to an employer who is committed to fostering an inclusive workplace and empowering employees with disabilities. And new for 2025, Disability Ally of the Year Award. It honors an individual who has shown exceptional dedication and advocacy in supporting individuals with disabilities. Guidelines, including the official nomination form and supplemental details describing the special accomplishments and contributions that qualify the nominee for the award, are available online. Mayor Kevin Hartke and the Chandler City Council will honor the award recipients during the council meeting on February 20. The Mayor's Committee for People with Disabilities advise council and staff on essential policies, rules, and regulations relating to advocacy issues experienced by the disabled of the community, such as accessibility, education, and employment. Members serve as advocates for those in the community with physical and mental disabilities, birth defects, injuries sustained due to accidents, illness, and age-related disabilities. The awards take place ahead of Disability Awareness Month, recognized by the City of Chandler annually in the month of March. For more information about the awards or the nomination process, email Adaptive Recreation or call 480-782-2908. The email address for Adaptive Recreation is adaptive.recreation@chandleraz.gov. This next piece comes from the University of Chicago magazine. It's entitled A Judge's Journey. Retired federal judge David S. Tatel, JD 66, reflects on how blindness shaped his life and career. By Susie Allen. Growing up, David S. Tatel, JD 66, imagined he would be a scientist like his father. But the civil rights movement and President John F. Kennedy's call for young people to enter public service set Tatel on a different path, one that led him to law school, the practice of civil rights law, the Office of Civil Rights, and eventually the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit, where he served as a judge until his retirement from the bench in 2023. Yet, as Tatel writes in his new book, Vision, A Memoir of Blindness and Justice, there is a curious irony at the heart of his career. Through many of the years he spent fighting to protect the rights of marginalized groups, he thought of civil rights law as something for other people and not for him, even as he was losing his sight because of a progressive genetic disease called retinitis pigmentosa. Tatel was diagnosed with the condition at age 15. By the time he had reached his 30s, he could no longer see words on a page. At the Office of Civil Rights, which he led from 1977 to 1979, Tatel worked to guide and enforce some of the nation's first laws preventing discrimination against people with disabilities. And here I was, the director of the office responsible for that, Tatel said. I had an obvious disability, yet I was hiding from it. Even when he began using a cane and concealing his blindness became impossible, Tatel chose not to discuss his disability in public. He would make different choices today. Looking back, he reflects in the book, I regret my refusal to discuss my blindness and the shame I felt when others mentioned it. I wasn't a judge who was just like everyone else, and the life experience born from my blindness was valuable, not shameful. Writing Vision forced him to be more open about his visual impairment and its effect on his life than he had ever been before. The book also offered Tatel an opportunity to look back on other aspects of his life and career. He recounts a memorable first date at Jimmy's with his now wife, Edie, as well as formative experiences in law school, where the intellectual environment was intense but invigorating. Law felt like science, but with words, or like political science, but with rules, he writes. Throughout my years on the D.C. circuit, I often found myself thinking and writing in ways I learned long ago in Chicago. As a judge on the D.C. circuit, Tatel handled cases about some of the most complex and important issues facing the nation, the fate of prisoners at the Guantanamo Bay detention camp, net neutrality, pollution, voting rights, and many others. In each instance, Tatel says, he tried to apply the law faithfully. Judicial restraint was his guiding philosophy, and it helped him grapple with the gravity of his position. I wasn't exercising my power, Tatel explains. I was exercising the power of the law, and I found that deeply comforting. Far less comforting, in Tatel's view, is the current Supreme Court's seeming abandonment of judicial restraint. He writes in Vision that his decision to retire from the D.C. Circuit stemmed in part from his concern about having to apply decisions whose reasoning seemed faulty and ideologically motivated. He mentions, for instance, Shelby County versus Holder and Brenovich versus Democratic National Committee, which severely weakened key provisions of the Voting Rights Act, as well as Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization and Students for Fair Admissions versus President and Fellows of Harvard College, which overturned previous rulings on abortion and affirmative action, respectively. I had no problem following Supreme Court decisions, even the ones that reversed me, for many years, because I respected the process they used, Tatel says. But when the court itself abandoned the principles of judging, I felt uncomfortable. I felt like I couldn't, in good faith, apply those decisions. Hopefully, he adds, the current members of the court will come to realize that the integrity of the institution on which they serve is perhaps more important than their own ideological objectives. Retirement from the D.C. Circuit has opened new possibilities. In addition to writing Vision, Tatel has rejoined his former firm, Hogan Lovells, to do pro bono work as senior counsel. He is also enjoying long walks with Vixen, his guide dog since 2019. He credits the 7-year-old German Shepherd with not only offering him new independence, but also making his blindness easier to discuss. You can't have a guide dog and not talk about it, he says. People want to talk about the dog, including Tatel himself. If talking too much about my dog is a crime, he writes in Vision, I plead guilty. Vixen has attracted lots of attention during publicity events for the book. She enjoys having her picture taken, Tatel notes, but it's not gone to her head. Close listening. As his vision worsened, Tatel came to rely on listening to do his work. In addition to his clerks, who dubbed themselves the Tatel Tots, he also hired a reader each year to help him digest case materials and draft opinions. Many were former debaters, practiced in the art of speaking quickly. Now, assistive technology, like the iPhone voice-over function, allows Tatel to navigate the digital world. Soon after he lost his ability to see words on a page, Tatel discovered talking books, a forerunner of today's audiobooks. Issued on vinyl records and later floppy disks, cassettes, and CDs, talking books were a revelation. For the first time in a long time, I could read on my own, he writes. Audiobooks remain a passion for Tatel, and he has gone from listener to narrator, having read the prologue and acknowledgments for audio versions of his book. This next article comes from the Atlanta Voice. It's entitled, President Carter's Resolute, Humble Leadership Saved Millions, Serves as a Guide for the World, by Dr. Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, Director General, World Health Organization. At WHO's headquarters in Geneva, a bronze statue stands outside the main entrance of an African boy walking ahead of his blinded father, guiding him with a long stick they both hold. This poignant artwork depicts how onchocerciasis, an ancient disease commonly known as river blindness, impacts many of the world's poorest people. Several replicas have been installed around the world, including, notably, the Carter Presidential Center in Atlanta, Georgia. The statue conveys many things: service, hope, the pride possessed by people who many see as vulnerable. Above all, it underscores how access to health is essential to enable each of us to live with dignity, no matter income or birthplace. President Carter, who I was privileged to have worked with closely for 2 decades, embodied and championed all this and more. While attending services in Washington, D.C., celebrating President Carter's life, I will pay tribute to the lasting legacies he left with the partnerships and programs that protect millions from the global threats of disease and war. President Carter saw afflictions like river blindness, malaria, and Guinea worm disease as debilitating drivers and results of poverty and insecurity. In the 1980s, around 3.5 million people lived with Guinea worm disease in Africa and Asia, a debilitating condition with no vaccine or treatment. It is caused by drinking stagnant water infected by parasites that, once ingested, grow into long worms that burrow painfully out of the patient's body through their skin. President Carter understood this disease preyed on the world's poorest, but could be fought with strategies owned by affected communities and countries and implemented with simple tools. In this case, a filter to separate the parasites from collected drinking water at source. In 1986, the World Health Assembly called for the disease's eradication. The Carter Center, which the president founded with his late wife Rosalind and Emory University, would play a leading role. It supported heads of state and health departments in affected countries and collaborated with global partners like the World Health Organization, the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and the Gates Foundation to mobilize needed resources. Since 2000, the disease has been eliminated from Southeast Asia, with around a dozen cases reported today in Africa. Global eradication is in sight, a result that ranks as one of President Carter's most important post-presidential achievements. While serving as Minister of Health in Ethiopia, I first met President Carter during his visit to inspect the health projects his center was supporting in the country. What impressed me then, and the many times we met after, was his humility and commitment to service. He strategically leveraged his position as a President of the United States to open doors to governments around the world and help build country-led solutions. That meeting in Addis Ababa about 20 years ago was immensely important personally. It started a close relationship built on shared goals of achieving health for all, respecting individual dignity and human rights, and pursuing peace. I was humbled in 2011 to be the first non-American recipient of the Jimmy and Rosalind Carter Humanitarian Award. I also appreciated the president's support for my campaign to become the first African elected Director General of the World Health Organization. The impact the Carters have had on people's well-being extends to mental health. Their center has drafted policy, reduced stigma, and raised the importance around mental health in the U.S. and beyond. In 2023, First Lady Carter was presented with the World Health Organization Award for Global Health to recognize her lifetime achievement in working on mental health issues. Importantly, President Carter recognized the links between health and peace. The Carter Center, he once said, always considered peace and health to be interrelated. The right of people to live in peace and the right of people to have adequate health care and to have their children survive are inseparable basic rights of a human being. By bringing Egypt and Israel together to forge the historic Camp David Accords and their 1979 peace deal, he showed it is possible to end war and build secure futures for people tired of conflict. The need for this in the Middle East today has never been stronger. In 1995, during Sudan's civil war, President Carter astutely negotiated a 6-month ceasefire to give health workers the space and security to undertake guinea worm disease, river blindness, and other health programs. During and after his presidency, President Carter also demonstrated the political and moral leadership of the United States over and again, and its role in advancing global security, collaboration, and health to protect everyone in America and around the world. These examples and more are prescient for today's volatile world. The divide between rich and poor has never been wider, nor has wealth been so concentrated in the hands of so few. And the perils we collectively face, wars, outbreaks, and climate change, have never felt more pressing. But President Carter's example, as a leader, a humanitarian, and a human, can guide us through these unclear times. I urge us all to follow his lead. And now from the Disability Scoop, a piece by Michelle Diament entitled, IRS Raises Able Account Deposit Limit. Starting this month, individuals with disabilities can accrue more money than ever before in a special type of account that allows people to save without jeopardizing access to Medicaid and other government benefits. Contributions to ABLE accounts can total up to $19,000 for 2025. That's an increase from $18,000 last year. The change comes after the Internal Revenue Service raised the federal gift tax limit. Since the cap on annual deposits for ABLE accounts is tied to that figure, it will grow too. ABLE accounts were established under a federal law a decade ago, offering people with disabilities the opportunity to save up to $100,000 without sacrificing eligibility for Social Security and other government benefits. Medicaid can be retained no matter how much is in the accounts. Money saved in the accounts can be used to pay for qualified disability expenses, including education, health care, transportation, and housing. Interest earned is tax-free. While annual ABLE account deposits are typically maxed at the gift tax limits, there is one exception. Individuals with disabilities who are employed can save some of their earnings so long as they do not contribute to a retirement plan and meet other requirements. Workers with disabilities living in the 48 contiguous states are allowed to save up to $15,060 in earnings in ABLE accounts above and beyond the gift tax limit for this year, according to Kathy Brannigan with the ABLE National Resource Center. That figure rises to $18,810 for Alaska residents and $17,310 for those in Hawaii. There are programs offering ABLE accounts in 47 states, nearly all of which are open to individuals nationwide with a disability that onset before the age of 26. Next year, eligibility for ABLE accounts will expand to include anyone with a disability that onset prior to age 46, a change that's expected to open up the program to an estimated 6 million additional people, Brannigan said. As of the end of September, there were 187,210 ABLE accounts open with $2.189 billion in assets, according to ISS Market Intelligence. You're listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. This is the Disability News Program, and I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Now here's another piece from the Disability Scoop entitled, Family Says Father and Son with Disabilities Were Left to Burn in California Wildfires, by Sonia Sharp, Los Angeles Times. Los Angeles. The last thing Anthony Mitchell Sr. told his eldest son was that he was still waiting for an ambulance as the swiftly moving Eaton fire bore down on his Altadena home. He called everybody and said, "I'm okay. I'm just waiting to be evacuated," the junior Mitchell said of their 5 a.m. phone call. He probably knew nobody was coming, but he wanted to keep everybody at ease. The great-grandfather and Mitchell family patriarch was an amputee who used a wheelchair. His son, Justin Mitchell, had cerebral palsy and needed help to get out of bed. They couldn't escape on their own, and relatives said firefighters stopped them from entering the evacuation zone. "He probably could have gotten up and walked away, but he's not going to leave my brother," Mitchell said. "My father would never leave any of his kids. His children were his legacy." So the pair huddled together, awaiting a rescue that never came, becoming two of the first victims of the unprecedented firestorms still raging across LA County. "What hurts the most is that our state didn't prepare for this at all," Mitchell said. "Officials have known for years that Californians with disabilities are disproportionately likely to die in wildfires. The state released a scathing audit in 2019 detailing how emergency management agencies and other first responders were unprepared for the threat. At the time, about 4 million Californians were estimated to have a disability, including almost a quarter million Angelenos under 65. Many say they feel even more vulnerable now. "You feel helpless," said actress and singer Josie Scott, 26, a wheelchair user in North Hollywood. "Evacuation procedures usually forget people with disabilities. It's a lot more difficult for us." Black residents like the Mitchells are much more likely to have a disability than white, Latino, or Asian ones, data show. They were among those who cannot evacuate without help. Others, such as Scott, are reluctant to flee, knowing the tools they rely on to breathe, move, eat, bathe, and go to the bathroom cannot come with them and aren't available at most shelters. "I have important medication I can't go without and mobility equipment that's very expensive and difficult to replace," Scott said. "It's really overwhelming." Even small and relatively inexpensive prescription medical goods, such as urinary catheters, can be onerous to find, especially in an emergency, the actress said. "Yet without them, I'm immediately at risk for kidney infection and sepsis." "Hers is a familiar anxiety," said Germaine Perotti, co-executive director of the Partnership for Inclusive Disaster Strategies and the main voice behind the Disability and Disaster Hotline, which has received calls from people fleeing the LA fires. "There's a fear of not knowing where to go, what to take with you," he said. "The sooner that organizations like mine know the needs, the sooner I can begin making sure it's sourced locally." Perotti said he has a direct line to state and federal disaster authorities. He and others also work closely with LA's independent living centers, which can quickly mobilize an oxygen tank or wheelchair to an Angeleno in need. "Our centers provide disaster plans and resources," said Renee Nash, an outreach worker with Communities Actively Living Independent and Free in downtown Los Angeles. "If people need motel vouchers, if they need access to Uber or Lyft, we do that for free. If you're on an oxygen concentrator or a Hoyer Lyft, Edison has us delivering Goal Zero Yeti battery backup so you can plug in your medical device," Nash explained. "People have said they're working great." But major obstacles remain, especially when it comes to evacuations. "They closed the roads down and nobody can get in to assist," said Sierra Ray, Disability Disaster Access and Resources Program Manager with the California Foundation for Independent Living. "Many people with disabilities don't drive or have access to a vehicle. Others fear getting mired in gridlock and burning alive in their cars. We saw a couple days ago a lot of people had to leave their cars and run for their lives, which is not an option for some with disabilities, Ray said. Recent malfunctions in the emergency alert system have only heightened the terror. I can't just jump out of bed and run real quick. I have to find someone who's willing to carry me down the stairs, said Tamara Mena, a wheelchair user in Northridge who was stuck in her apartment for days when a power shutoff downed her apartment's elevators. Every minute, every second counts. Others said they were frustrated by the lack of communication from officials. If people weren't sharing these resources, I wouldn't know about them, which I think is kind of messed up, Scott said. This should be widespread information already. The city, state, and federal governments have offices charged with ensuring people with disabilities are not left behind in disasters. Each declined to make officials available for comment. For Mitchell, the grief over losing his father and brother is tinged with fury at the way they died. I'm angry at what happened to my father because it shouldn't have happened, he said. The institutions let him down. This next article comes from The Wrap. The title is Hollywood's Disability Coordinators Streamline Production, Expand Access. Production access coordinators are a game changer for inclusion in the entertainment industry. By Kristen Lopez. A burgeoning new role in the entertainment industry is opening up long-awaited opportunities for greater representation of disability. Production Access Coordinators, PACs. The inaccessibility of sets, audition spaces, and studio lots all too often pose barriers to hiring inclusively. But PACs are helping change this, guiding productions to be accessible to all. Many industry professionals are not fully aware of the specific needs and accommodations required for people with disabilities, Aisha Chai Chang, a freelance production accessibility coordinator whose credits include Hulu series and Jennifer Lopez's upcoming Amazon Studios release Unstoppable, told The Wrap. Studios don't believe that their crew members or cast could be people with disabilities. This knowledge gap and lack of acknowledgement for people with disabilities furthers the lack of prioritization on implementing effective accessibility measures. Chai Chang pivoted from filmmaking to production access in 2020 upon realizing she had to disclose her own respiratory disabilities to her cast and crew on a film project. She realized the fear of people disclosing they were disabled limited their accommodations on set. During a recent Hollywood Radio and Television Society, HRTS, workshop on disability inclusion presented by Easter Seals Disability Services and hosted by Amazon MGM Studios, Jerome Kaur, Amazon's head of U.S. and worldwide DEIA content, echoed that he often encounters concerns about disclosure. One of our biggest issues is a studio getting folks with disabilities to trust us, to say that they have a disability, and that will not negatively impact their employment. As Kaur explained, Amazon approaches accessibility and accommodations through the lens of providing productivity tools that support all employees to thrive in the work environment. As such, disclosure is a pathway to securing that support, and PACs can help facilitate that process. Actor Nicole Lynn Evans worked with longtime PAC Kai Amara when she appeared in Apple TV's Best Foot Forward and declared the experience a revelation. Working with a production accessibility coordinator allowed me to be fully immersed in my work, knowing my access needs were handled, she said. This role should be standardized. It ensures the workplace is accessible for everyone and is a proactive solution, empowering people with disabilities to succeed in the roles they specifically hired for, whether in front of or behind the camera. Unfortunately, studios aren't yet widely ensuring that PACs are part of production budgets, even though the expense has a high return on investment for the overall production experience and output. Having an accessibility coordinator is often seen as a luxury rather than a necessity, Chai Chang said. There's a belief that thinking about accessibility will only add to the cost without realizing the potential benefits, such as reduced health and safety issues and more efficient production processes. Fear the Walking Dead actor Daryl Mitchell previously revealed that because he was worried about asking for too much, he provided his own wheelchair-accessible trailer. This kind of responsibility to ensure accessibility on set should not fall on disabled talent. Production access coordinators can help alleviate these pressures, serving as a liaison between leadership, cast, and crew to navigate access requests to foster a more welcoming, inclusive workplace culture. In many cases, there are simple fixes to accessibility issues, and resolutions can be reached with open communication. The goal is to bring more people with disabilities into the production access coordinating industry and to make the role standardized across all productions. Film director Ashley Aiken, one of the founders of the DGA Disability Committee, shared that she hopes PACs become just as standard as intimacy coordinators. After all, Aiken pointed out, we learned from COVID that when needed, we can add safety measures or create roles practically overnight. But to expand the presence of PACs, the industry needs to commit to making it happen. At the HRTS Disability Inclusion event, Keely Catwells, founder and CEO of Making Space, reminded everyone that just like any other role out there, we need training, we need pipeline development. Access coordinators present this incredible opportunity for disabled people to have new pathways into employment within this industry. Indeed, it's an exciting time not only for the continued progress toward disability representation on screen, but also the work to create inclusive spaces behind the scenes. Production access coordinator is an essential role that will truly lead to better outcomes on set and for audiences alike. This next article comes from Psychology Today. It's entitled, Ableism is a Major Barrier to Mental Health Care. Why America's Largest Minority Group is Struggling to Access Mental Health Care, by Kathleen R. Bogart, Ph.D. The largest socially marginalized group of Americans is struggling to access mental health care, the support many of them want. One in four Americans has a disability. And while people with disabilities are more likely to have mental health concerns and utilize mental health services, their needs remain largely unmet. In a recently published study, we investigated where mental health services fall short and how care can be improved for people with disabilities in the future. We interviewed 20 U.S. adults in fall 2022 about their experiences seeking and receiving mental health services. Participants aged 22 to 67 reported a wide range of visible and invisible disabilities and were diverse in terms of race, ethnicity, gender identity, and sexual orientation. Notably, 80% of the sample identified as having multiple disabilities. Participants' narratives revealed six overarching themes that demonstrate the various dimensions of ableism while seeking and receiving mental health care. misplaced assumptions. This first theme represents instances where a participant's disability identity was either viewed as the sole focus of mental health treatment or completely ignored. One participant described being denied therapy by their campus counseling center and referred to disability services after the initial consult in which their autism was revealed. Another participant described the opposite situation. When I lost my vision, I sought out a therapist that could help me sort of work through all of the issues that came along with that, but they were more concerned about what happened with my childhood or something else. Medical trauma and gaslighting. The second theme exposed instances where providers discounted participants' knowledge of their own medical needs or discredited their lived experiences. Participants described being invalidated or dismissed by providers when advocating for safe, effective care. For example, asking providers to wear a mask as a COVID-19 precaution or requesting an autism diagnostic assessment. Interpersonal ableism. Within the third theme, participants reported various disability-based microaggressions from their providers. One participant was told that she should let others take on the work of community organizing due to the perceived burden her wheelchair would have on an event, while others described experiences of providers speaking with their family members rather than addressing them directly. Lack of disability knowledge. Not all of therapists are very well educated on chronic illnesses and disabilities. A sentiment shared by one participant was a common refrain and clearly articulates the fourth theme. Further, many discussed providers' apparent lack of interest in educating themselves about disability topics or concerns. Accessibility challenges. The fifth theme captures the many environmental and technical barriers identified when accessing mental health services. Transportation to appointments and physical barriers in offices, for example, crowded rooms and hallways that are difficult to navigate with a wheelchair, were common challenges in accessing in-person care. Notably, telehealth also posed its own lack of access barriers, with limited internet access and lack of accessibility features in virtual meeting platforms, for example, captioning, as major pain points. Systemic ableism. The sixth theme underscores the deeply rooted ableist nature of mental health institutions, policies, and practices. One participant powerfully stated, "The established networks were built from their very beginning on eugenicist, cis-heteronormative, white supremacist ideals overtly and openly. There is no version of that that will ever be even physically safe for a person like me to encounter." One final aspect of this study was an examination of the intersectional and compounding impact disability identities have on other marginalized identities in the context of mental health services. Insight into how people with disabilities navigate this intersectionality is one of the novel contributions of this study. One participant clearly articulated what this experience is like. "Socially, I just really feel like I wouldn't necessarily be acknowledged for all of my identities, and that's kind of stopped me from seeking out mental health services." Taken together, this study showcased resilience and adaptability as people with disabilities navigate the challenges of seeking and receiving mental health services. However, many participants also emphasized the crucial need for providers to meet them where they are, consider accessibility, listen, and trust them as experts on their own lived experiences. Providers can begin to bridge the disability divide through open, ongoing conversations instead of relying on stereotypical assumptions or avoiding disability-related topics altogether. In addition to interpersonal consideration, systematic changes are needed to address the lack of disability competency training, the underrepresentation of disabled providers, and a lack of sensitivity to the unique concerns associated with intersecting marginalized identities among providers. If you are a person with a disability seeking mental health care, look for someone with specialized training or experience in disability. Psychology Today has a feature to search for therapists with certain disability-related specialties, including chronic illness, intellectual disability, traumatic brain injury, ADHD, autism, chronic pain, and learning disabilities. Many providers offer a free initial consultation, which may be a good opportunity to inquire about prior experience working with disabled clients and familiarity with ableism. And this final article comes from Engadget. It's entitled, Dot Lumen's Haptic Headset Could Help Blind People Navigate. It uses computer vision and vibration haptics to guide people around obstacles, by Daniel Cooper. Dot Lumen founder Cornell Amariai describes his product as a self-driving system to enable blind and low vision people a way to get around. It's essentially the electronic equivalent to a guide dog, helping users avoid obstacles when walking around. The Romanian company turned up to CES 2025 in Las Vegas, armed with prototypes of its headset that it hopes will make blind people's lives a lot easier. The headset looks like a chunky piece of VR gear with a front unit sitting on your forehead just above your eyes. There's a chunky power and processing pack on the rear that keeps the bulky device's weight balanced while walking around. In the front, there are 6 computer vision cameras, 3 near field and 3 pointed farther away, which Amariai says was inspired by Tesla's setup. Collision avoidance is the main priority here, preventing you from bumping into other pedestrians or street obstacles. In front of the headset are a series of little arms that make contact with your forehead, each one tied to a vibrating motor. When the vibrations are in the center of your forehead, it's safe for you to move forward. But when the vibrations move either side, you should turn to refocus. There is also a voice guide, and this will chime in to let you know when the view in front of you is getting crowded. Amariai told me that the headset has a battery life of around 2.5 hours, which is more than enough for an average walk. But that if you do need some extra juice, you can hook up a USB-C battery pack and carry that around with you as well. Testing the headset in the less than ideal environment of CES was a great way to see how serious the company is. After all, the ceilings are low, the walkways narrow, and there are always hundreds of people who just walk at you, expecting you to throw yourself out of the way. Which is why I wore a blindfold and strapped the prototype to my head in order to roam the floor at Eureka Park. It's obviously quite hard to describe the sensation navigating a space using only gentle taps on your forehead. I certainly was quite hesitant taking small steps and slowly moving forward, letting the headset guide me on my journey through. When crowds thronged past me in tight formation, the hardware's audio guide said narrow, telling me the space around me was in short supply. What impressed me is that I was able to navigate the scrum without bumping into anyone and managed to get a fair way through the hall. Naturally, I can't speak to the headset's long-term effectiveness, especially as someone who can see, but the technology certainly feels like it could be very useful. Amari said Dot Lumen will begin selling its headset in Europe in the near future, with the price expected to come in under 10,000 euro. As steep as that sounds, he added, the price to train a guide dog is significantly higher. In the U.S., the Guide Dog Foundation says it costs $50,000 to breed, raise, train, and place an assistance dog. Well, that's our program for this time. Thanks for tuning in to the Disability News. Thanks for listening to Sun Sounds of Arizona. I'm John Curry, your volunteer reader. Until next time.